Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Steve Brown. Tonight we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Howard Gotlieb Archival Research Center titled The True Flag, Theodore Roosevelt, Mark Twain, and the Birth of American Empire. Our speaker is author and journalist Stephen Kinzer. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Liz Shannon, president of the Friends of the Howard Gotlieb Archival Research Center.
Stephen Kinzer is an award-winning foreign correspondent whose articles and books have led the Washington Post to place him, quote, among the best in popular foreign policy storytelling. I love that description. One of the many reasons our guest is able to write so vividly and so persuasively about world affairs as because he has spent the majority of his storied career observing them at close range. Mr. Kinzer spent more than 20 years working for the New York Times, most of it as a foreign correspondent. He was the Times bureau chief in Nicaragua during the 1980s, in Germany during the early 1990s, and in 1996, he was named chief of the newly opened Times Bureau in Istanbul. Later, he was appointed national culture correspondent based in Chicago. Since leaving the Times, Stephen Kinzer has taught journalism, political science, and international relations at Northwestern University and here at Boston University. He has written books about Central America, Rwanda, Turkey, and Iran, as well as others that trace the history of American foreign policy. And he writes a world affairs column for the Boston Globe, which we always look for avidly. Kirkus Review sums up Kinzer's latest book, which is entitled The True Flag, Theodore Roosevelt, Mark Twain, and the Birth of American Empire as, quote, a timely work on the vociferous sides taken over the Spanish-American War of 1898 and how that history relates to the ongoing debate regarding American imperialism. The Foreign Policy Journal praises Kinzer's writing as, quote, history at its best. Kirkus calls it a tremendously elucidating book that should be required reading for civics courses everywhere. Professor Kinzer is currently a senior fellow at Brown University's Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs, and a collection of his papers dealing with his time in Nicaragua is held here at the Gotlieb Archival Research Center. Please help me in welcoming a good friend of the Gotlieb Center back to BU to discuss his new book, The True Flag, Professor Kinzer.
We have never had a president before who was destitute of self-respect and of respect for his high office. We have had no president before who was not a gentleman. We've had no president before who was intended for a butcher, a dive keeper, or a bully. No, those words were not written this week. That was Mark Twain talking about Theodore Roosevelt. Twain and Roosevelt were actually marvelously matched antagonists. In some ways, they were completely different. Teddy Roosevelt was a spoiled rich kid who grew up with fantasies of armies and navies, played with little toy boats in his bathtub, never went to school until he got to Harvard. Teddy Roosevelt believed, that wasn't really school for him either, Teddy Roosevelt believed that war was the only noble endeavor for a man or for a nation. I would favor almost any war, for I feel our country needs it. I even found a letter from him to his bosom buddy, Henry Cabot Lodge, in which he's speculating on whether it might not be possible somehow to get Germany to attack and burn some American cities on the East Coast so that America would finally spend money building up its military. Teddy Roosevelt believed it was America's destiny and obligation to go out in the world and rule the dusky peoples who were not able to govern themselves. Mark Twain was a completely different character. He, too, had traveled the world, but not just to shoot animals. He had gone there to observe how people lived. He had been in places where European imperialism showed its ugliest face, like South Africa, the Indian subcontinent. He had tremendous sympathy for the native peoples who Roosevelt held in complete contempt. Roosevelt was a great believer in the absolute virtue of America and the great message of our flag. Here's Teddy Roosevelt. "Our flag is a proud flag, and it stands for liberty and civilization. Where it has once floated, there must and shall be no return to tyranny or savagery." By which he means, of course, no return to native rule. Mark Twain saw the American flag a little bit differently. He believed that American soldiers fighting in foreign wars, as he wrote, were carrying a polluted musket under a bandit's flag. He even wanted to change the flag of the United States to replace the stars with skull and crossbones. Both of these guys, though, had some similarities. They were both real prima donnas. They created their own images. They were egomaniacs who could never turn away from a crowd or an interviewer or a photographer. Because they were aware of each other's personalities and each other's popularity, they didn't want to attack each other in public. We do know, however, from their private comments and writings what they really thought of each other. So Twain considered Roosevelt clearly insane. And the most formidable disaster that has befallen our country since the Civil War. Roosevelt returned the favor by saying he would like to skin Mark Twain alive. So, what were they arguing about? It was what one senator called the greatest question that has ever been presented to the American people. He was right. It was then, and it still is. The question is, should the United States be pushing its military and coercive power into other countries? Or is it better for us to allow other countries to find their own way and devote our energies to building up our own country? This is a question that Americans have never really managed to resolve. We have a divided soul. And the question of how we should behave in the world continues to puzzle us. It's our great national conundrum. There are times when we get indignant and outraged and we want to project our power and invade and bomb and occupy and overthrow. Then we begin to see the blowback. We experience the sorrows of empire. We see the troubles, and we sort of calm down until the cycle starts up again. So Americans are actually bad imperialists. We didn't set out on this path intentionally like the British did or the French or the Spanish. It happened by accident, and we still haven't decided if this is really who we are and who we want to be. So for those of you that might have forgotten a little bit about that one lesson you had in high school about the Spanish-American War, which I'm sure is a small minority, let me just set the historical scene. So in 1890, the U.S. Census Bureau famously declared that the American frontier was closed. So no more room to expand inside North America. You could argue that America had been an expansionist power ever since the Pilgrims landed at Plymouth. We've been moving westward. And we were told that it was our manifest destiny to spread ourselves over the entire North American continent. We did that during the 19th century by crushing Native Americans and seizing a large part of Mexico. We created what you might call our continental empire. So now what? We filled up the continent. So we've been expanding as long as we've been a nation. Do we stop now and concentrate our efforts in building the great continental nation we've established? Or, having been expansionist by nature, do we continue beyond the natural borders of North America? This was a little bit of an abstract question until 1898. I believe that was the year when the United States changed more dramatically than in any year in our history. At the beginning of 1898, we were just as happy as we were in 1897 and 1896 and the years before that. We were comfortable within our own boundaries. By the end of that year, we had set off on the course of overseas empire. So what happened? During the late 1890s, Cuban patriots had been rebelling against Spanish colonial rule. Americans didn't pay much attention because then, as now, we're totally unaware of what's going on in the rest of the world. However, during 1898, this Cuban revolution against Spain attracted the attention of the great publisher William Randolph Hearst. Hearst was the inventor of what was then called yellow journalism. We now call it fake news. Hearst was the inventor of fake news. I can tell you, having spent many hours in a darkened room at the New York Public Library cranking through the microfilms of all the New York journals published in 1898, that William Randolph Hearst had a brilliant insight. He had been given this newspaper by his father in California. The father had won it as a gambling debt. A guy that he had beaten in poker said, "Well, I can't pay you, but I have a newspaper in New York. Would you take it?" And the father said, "Yeah," and then he gave it to his son. So young William went off to New York. He started trying to build up circulation with a steady diet of stories about murder, suicide, children in terrible problems, and political corruption. But after a while, he realized with a clever entrepreneur's eye that these stories tend to run into each other. They're all the same. They blend into each other. They get boring after a while. Hearst understood something that news entrepreneurs even today know, and that is if you want to get people to buy newspapers or click on your cell phones, you've got to have a running story. You want a story that makes people tune in every day. And the best running story of all is war. Hearst realized that if we could get American soldiers involved in some war somewhere, everyone would buy the New York Journal every day. And he set out quite consciously to foment a war in Cuba and bring American troops into that war. So how did he do that? Cuban revolutionaries had been fighting against the Spanish for several years. We hadn't paid any attention. Hearst had a brilliant insight, which our leaders today still use. Hearst realized that Americans are very compassionate people. We hate the idea that anybody is suffering anywhere, and we feel that we can stop it. We want to go if anybody's being hurt somewhere. All you need to do to get us to war is to show us a picture of some poor girl who's had acid thrown in her face because she tried to go to school, and we say, "That's so awful, we got to bomb that country." It was the same way then. So Hearst started publishing a diet of stories about the horrible brutalities that Spanish officers were imposing on innocent Cuban civilians. I read a number of these stories. I remember one in particular which took up an entire page full of illustrated with very evocative drawings. It was a story about a holding pen outside of Havana in which a particularly brutal Spanish officer had herded groups of peasants who had been captured outside the protected villages where they were required to stay. This was outdoors, no refuge from the sun, no sanitation, no medicine, no food, and no water. And the reporter described the awful conditions there, and you can see from the pictures the ribs breaking through and the awful suffering of these Cuban civilians. And the most vivid part of the story is that the reporter actually watched a young woman die in one of these camps, and then a few minutes later watched her baby die. Later it turned out this reporter had never even been in Cuba. It was a complete fantasy. And then Hearst crowned it all with maybe the greatest fake news story in history, according to what effect it had, and that was the sinking of the USS Maine, the American warship that was sent to Havana Harbor. That ship went down after a terrible explosion, carrying more than 200 Americans to their deaths. The headline on the journal the next day was, "Sinking of the Maine was the work of an enemy." And they actually published on the front page a diagram showing how the Spanish had blown up that ship. You see a drawing of the Maine lying at anchor, and below the waterline you can see where the Spaniards attached the mine, and then you can see the cables attached to the detonator on shore where the Spanish officers pushed the plunger to blow up the American ship. Well, it wasn't until 70 years later that the U.S. Navy convened an investigating commission under Admiral Hyman Rickover that concluded that without doubt the Maine had exploded because of a spark inside the furnace. But we didn't know that at the time, and we didn't want to hear that. Hearst was the mighty megaphone that projected this horror, this idea that Americans were under attack to our public. And it was very effective. Americans did decide that we had to send troops to Cuba to help the brave Cuban revolutionaries fight Spain. Our military commanders then concluded, quite reasonably, that since we were now going to be at war with Spain, we had to worry that the Spanish naval fleet might attack the U.S. mainland in retribution. So we had to find the Spanish fleet and sink it, but we couldn't find it. It turned out it wasn't in Spain. It wasn't anywhere near Cuba. We finally found out where it was. It was in a place that no American had ever heard of, the Philippine Islands. So the Philippines had been a Spanish colony for centuries. We sent our squadron to the Philippines, and we sunk the Spanish fleet in a battle that took about an hour and a half. Everything was fine, but the next morning, we were faced with something we never imagined. So the Philippines had been a Spanish colony for so long. Now the Spanish fleet is at the bottom of the ocean. What do we do with the Philippines? This was supposed to be a war about Cuba. We never thought about the Philippines, but suddenly, there it was. So what do we do? Do we allow it to become an independent nation? There was already a rebellion against Spanish rule. The desire of Filipino patriots was to have their own nation. But maybe we should take the Philippines for ourselves. When this idea emerged in the United States, there was a huge reaction. When the United States decided to go to war in Cuba, all Americans were in favor. There was huge understanding. This was a great concept because we were only defending the brutalized, oppressed Cubans. Suddenly, we began to talk about not only taking the Philippines, but maybe we shouldn't allow Cuba to become independent either. Maybe we could dominate Cuba. And how about Puerto Rico right next door? Then there was Guam over there in the Pacific. So this is when the Americans decided maybe we should begin to follow the example of European powers and start taking colonies and principalities and projecting our military power around the world. This caused an explosion of protest inside the United States. It began right here in Boston. The first anti-imperialist meeting in American history was held at Faneuil Hall, June 15th, 1898. Here's an excerpt from the opening speech by Charles Ames, a Unitarian clergyman and theologian. The policy of imperialism threatens to change the temper of our people and to put us into a permanent attitude of arrogance, testiness, and defiance toward other nations. Once we enter the field of international conflict as a great military and naval power, we shall be only one more bully among bullies. We shall only add one more to the list of oppressors of mankind. After this meeting, a national organization emerged called the Anti-Imperialist League. It had a huge impact in America. It had chapters all over the country, held meetings in many cities, published hundreds of thousands of brochures and broadsides and newsletters. The great discovery of my book is that the decision the United States made to begin projecting its power in the outside world was not automatic. It wasn't something that came as a matter of course. In fact, the entire country was involved in an intense debate over whether this was a good idea. Every major political and intellectual and literary figure in America took sides in this debate. It riveted the entire country. This, to me, is the untold story of that era. So at the end of 1898, the U.S. imposed a treaty on the Spanish under which we would take the Philippines, for which we paid them $20 million to make them feel better. We took Guam. We took Puerto Rico. Spain also had to surrender Cuba. And this treaty had to be ratified by the U.S. Senate. That set off an epic 32-day debate, which was not just about this treaty, not just about the Philippines. It was about the question of what kind of country the United States was going to be. The debate is one of the great moments in American history. It began with one senator getting up and saying, "This is the greatest question that has ever been presented to the American people." He was right. It was. It still is. How should the United States relate to the outside world? Should we try to project our power militarily and make other countries do what we want them to do? Or should we decline to join the club of imperial powers and devote our energies to building up the United States so it could be an example for other countries rather than trying to dominate those other countries? Now, this is the founding debate in the history of American foreign policy. The great questions of our foreign policy can all be reduced down to one theme, and actually they can all be reduced down to one word, and that is intervention. So where do we intervene? When do we intervene? With what tools? With what goals? We have been debating this question for over 100 years. And although, because of my reading and my teaching, I've always been very aware of the Spanish-American War and the American conquest of the Philippines and the terrible brutality of that war, what I had never realized, and what I think has been lost to history, is the intensity of this debate. In the whole history of American foreign policy, this is the mother of all debates. Every argument we have made in favor of intervening abroad or against intervening abroad was first made during this great 32-day debate in the U.S. Senate. There's nothing new, except for one thing, which is, I noticed this as I was going through the congressional record of this long debate. I really think I might have been the first person in 50 years to open that book. What I discovered is that the senators in those days were so articulate, so sophisticated, you'd never imagine that today. Their speeches are masterpieces of classical oratory, beautifully framed, full of references to Pliny the Elder, the Catiline conspiracy, things you'd never dare to discuss with a U.S. senator today. But the arguments resonate so fully towards what we're doing today. Let me just give you a few examples. One of the most interesting parts of this story, which really is a Boston and Massachusetts-based story, is that two of the greatest antagonists in the Senate debate were the two Republican senators from Massachusetts. One was Henry Cabot Lodge, probably the principal conceiver and organizer of the imperial project. You could claim that the imperialist triumvirate was composed of Lodge, Teddy Roosevelt as the public face, and Hearst as the mighty megaphone. And the other Republican senator from Massachusetts was George Frisbie Hoar from Worcester, actually born in Concord. And they epitomized the two poles of this argument, not just then, but now. So let me read you a couple of these lines. Here's Henry Cabot Lodge. Ask yourself how resonant these phrases are. I do not believe that this nation was raised up for nothing. I have faith that it has a great mission in the world, a mission of good, a mission of freedom. We have been told this over and over again. I vividly remember at the end of the Cold War, when President George H.W. Bush announced that we're not going to begin pulling back from our Cold War era security commitments now that the Cold War is over. We're going to do the opposite. We are going to project our power even further. And the reason is that the United States has the job of doing the hard work of freedom. It's the same argument. As soon as Lodge had finished, George Frisbie Hoar jumped up and said, "You have no right at the cannon's mouth to impose on an unwilling people your Declaration of Independence and your Constitution and your notions of freedom and notions of what is good." Now, one of the great arguments that was made during this period is that the United States was founded in rebellion against an overseas colonizer. Our principle is that all government derives its legitimacy from the consent of the governed. How then can we try to govern other people and force them to do what we want? So here is Senator Albert Beveridge, one of the leading imperialists, who answers this question. "The opposition tells us that we ought not to govern a people without their consent. I answer, the rule of liberty, that all just government derives its authority from the consent of the governed, applies only to those who are capable of self-government," by which, of course, he means white people. This was the great debate that shook our country then, and I think it still is shaking our country. At that time, President McKinley had the very difficult task of trying to explain to Americans why it was right for American soldiers to travel thousands of miles and shoot down people who honestly believed that they were fighting for their own freedom and independence. It's a difficult geopolitical circle to square. McKinley decided that the place to make his great speech would be the heart of enemy territory, the homeland of the anti-imperialist league, Boston. So sure enough, he got on a train in a big snowstorm in Washington and traveled to Boston. The home market club, which was made up of businessmen very eager to exploit the resources of foreign nations and find markets there, was his host. It was the biggest banquet ever staged in the history of the U.S. up to that time. Over 2,000 people crowded into Mechanics Hall, right where the Prudential Center is now. And McKinley gave this explanation for why it was right for us to fight in other countries against people who hated the fact that we were there. I love this line, and it resonates today. Did we need their consent to perform a great act for humanity? We had it in every aspiration of their minds, in every hope of their hearts. What he was saying essentially is, America has a great gift to give the world. We've discovered the formula that creates a country that's prosperous and free. How selfish it would be for us to keep this secret to ourselves. We must share it with others. And the ones we need to share it with the most are those who are so backward they don't even realize they need our help. This debate shook the nation. And I'll tell you, during these 32 days, there was never a front page of any American newspaper that didn't have stories about what was going on in Washington. Every day in the newspapers, there were tallies. How many senators on this side? How many senators on this side? Is this guy wavering? Is the other one going to switch sides? The White House was intensely active in offering various emoluments to senators to try to get them to vote one way in favor of the treaty. Even foreign diplomats based in Washington were sending back reports constantly to their home countries about how the debate was going. That's why this was the greatest question ever presented to the American people. It was bigger than slavery, because slavery only affected people inside the United States. This was a decision that was going to affect everyone in the whole world. So the debate reached a climax and finally came to a vote, and the vote was amazingly close. The decision to ratify the Treaty of Paris and to take the Philippines and Puerto Rico and these other territories, and in a larger sense, to begin pressing American power beyond North America, was passed with one vote more than the required two-thirds majority. One vote. Then the anti-imperialists took this question to the Supreme Court. And the question was, as it was colloquially framed, does the Constitution follow the flag? In other words, where we rule, do we have to give people constitutional rights? If we did, then the imperial project is over right away. The Supreme Court ruled that it was constitutional. We could do that. A vote was 5-4, one vote majority. And interestingly enough, the judge who wrote the majority decision had just a couple of years earlier also participated in the majority in the Plessy versus Ferguson case, in which we ruled segregation to be acceptable. And that made sense, because if you believed that certain Americans deserve more rights than others, you could also believe that certain people in other countries deserve more or less rights than we have. So here was the debate that set us off onto this course. For me, the great discovery of this book is that this debate ever happened. All my books are voyages of discovery. I'm always looking for some huge story that shaped world history, but that we don't know anything about. And it's amazing how many of these there are. So I feel I've recovered a great historical episode that we've forgotten. One of the reasons this is important is that for those of us who feel that Americans have gone off on a wrong path in foreign policy, this book shows that we're not inventing this idea. This is nothing new, and this is nothing marginal. This is a very rich tradition that goes back more than a century in American history. Let me tell you who was involved in the Anti-Imperialist League. So the president of the Anti-Imperialist League was George Boutwell, former governor of Massachusetts, U.S. Senator, Secretary of the Treasury, co-founder of the Republican Party, vituperative campaigner against the Ku Klux Klan, great promoter of the constitutional amendments to protect African Americans in the South. Vice presidents included people like William Jennings Bryan, the leader of the Democratic Party, Grover Cleveland, the last Democratic president, Benjamin Harrison, the last Republican president, Andrew Carnegie, the richest man in America, who wrote a brilliant article wondering how we would ever be able to post the Declaration of Independence on the wall in any country that we ruled, since we have made it illegal to demand independence in that country. And he finished his article with a beautiful phrase. He said, "Tires the Republic so soon of its mission?" People sitting around the table at the Anti-Imperialist League meetings were not the sort of people that Andrew Carnegie would normally associate with. So Jane Addams, the great social reformer, the labor leader Samuel Gompers, William James, the great American philosopher, Booker T. Washington, the greatest African-American leader of that period, were all outspoken anti-imperialists. And this remarkable coalition left behind a great heritage. They were the counters to the triumvirate that I mentioned of Lodge, Hearst, and Roosevelt. So the great discovery of my book is that this debate ever happened. But as often happens when you write books, and this is one of the compensating virtues for writing books, despite all the trouble that it causes, is that you discover other things in the course of your work. The next big discovery that I had to do with Mark Twain. So I grew up with what I now realize was a very partial view of Mark Twain. I always thought of Mark Twain as Mr. Sweetheart, nice guy, beloved by everybody, rocking on his front porch with his nice white curls, writing cute stories and making gentle jokes that everybody loved. This was not Mark Twain. He was actually a vituperative anti-imperialist. Most of the quotes you'll find in my book from Mark Twain do not appear in any biography or any anthology. I now realize we've bleached Mark Twain's image. We've made him seem really like a sweetheart, but he was no sweetheart. He was a very tough guy. For example, I give you just one piece of his writings. This one could have been written today. "It was impossible to save the great republic. She was rotten to the heart. Lust of conquest had long ago done its work. Trampling upon the helpless abroad had taught her by a natural process to endure with apathy the like at home. The government was irrevocably in the hands of the prodigiously rich and their hangers-on. The suffrage was become a mere machine which they used as they chose. There was no principle but commercialism and no patriotism but of the pocket." So one reason that I feel this is such an important story to tell is that Americans have never managed to resolve this contradiction. We want to guide the world, but we also want every country to guide itself. So these are opposites. You can't believe both, but we do. We hold both of these ideas in our head, and we've never managed to decide where we want to go. I think our current president epitomizes this. One day it's, we wasted trillions of dollars in the Middle East, and we should never fight another regime change war. The next day it's, we're putting Iran on notice, and we're going to solve the problem in Syria with our military, and we're going to spend an extra $50 billion on the army to prove it. So which tweet is us? It's the same question, minus the tweet part, that we've been asking ourselves for over 100 years. We've never managed to understand what we want to do and what we want to be in the world. Sometimes we become outraged. We're indignant at the offenses we have suffered and the brutality that we see in other countries, and we bomb and we invade and we overthrow. Then the blowback begins. We begin to understand the sorrows of empire. Things go badly. We begin to see the criticism, the blood, the troubles that it's caused, and we begin to calm down. We don't do it anymore. Until the cycle starts up again. We are still on this treadmill. And I think understanding the background of this argument and understanding that we made this choice very narrowly helps tell us that this is still a vibrant debate. I believe that there is a constituency out there in the United States for a more restrained, prudent, respectful foreign policy. But we've never had the intellectual or political leadership that is able to congeal this into a real movement. The right-left spectrum is not useful in figuring out who's in favor of intervention and not. If you go back to the 1940s, you'll find the left-wing Democrat Henry Wallace and the right-wing Republican Robert Taft agreeing that it's a stupid idea for the United States to begin crashing into other countries. Later, you have George McGovern and Pat Buchanan making the same argument. So there is an unhappiness on both ends about the American interventionist project. Here's another great line to show you how clearly people at that time saw what was ahead. So William Graham Sumner was one of the brilliant professors who was an anti-imperialist spokesman. He's the founder of the discipline of sociology, and not incidentally, the inventor of the term ethnocentrism. Here's what he said in 1899 in a speech in Cambridge. The great foe of democracy now and in the near future is plutocracy. Every year that passes brings out this antagonism more distinctly. It is to be the social war of the 20th century. In that war, militarism, expansionism, and imperialism will all favor plutocracy. Therefore, expansion and imperialism are a grand onslaught on democracy. Now, I mentioned to you that I made various discoveries in the course of this book. The great one is the scope of this argument and how big it was and how close the decision was to plunge into the course that we followed for the last 120 years. The second one was Mark Twain. And the final one was my discovery of my new hero, a guy that I had never heard of before. I'm a little bit embarrassed to say. Let me ask you, though. This makes me always feel better. I'm not the only one. I think this guy really has been lost to American history. Has anybody ever heard the name of Carl Schurz? Do you live on the east side of New York? Carl Schurz Park? Is that why you know it? No. So as far, the only people that I've ever met that know who Carl Schurz was realize that the park outside Gracie Mansion in New York is called Carl Schurz Park. But when I asked them, do you know anything else about Carl Schurz? No. Well, I didn't either. Carl Schurz is my new hero. I actually found out that the U.S. has issued a stamp for him, and I went out and bought it. I have it on my wall, and actually, Carl Schurz was a native of Germany. The Germans have also issued a stamp for him. So I have the two of them up there in my little mini shrine. Carl Schurz fought as a teenager in the 1848 revolution in Germany. He had to flee after that revolution was crushed. He came to the country that was the beacon of liberty, the United States. There he became involved in the abolitionist movement. He was a supporter of Abraham Lincoln. Lincoln made him consul to Spain. When the Civil War broke out, he came home. He became a general in the Civil War, commanded troops at Gettysburg and Chancellorsville. After the war, Carl Schurz became the first German-born U.S. senator from Missouri. Later, he became Secretary of the Interior. He was a huge figure in American life. And at the end of the 19th century, all Americans would have known his name. He was the greatest campaigner for good government, anti-corruption, civic reform. He also had a great appearance that made him attractive to cartoonists, just like Teddy Roosevelt had the buck teeth and Mark Twain had the curly white locks. Carl Schurz had a big black beard, and you see it in many cartoons. In my book, I not only have a photo of Schurz, but a cartoon in which he appears, and all Americans would have recognized him. So Carl Schurz became one of the most articulate anti-imperialists. January 2nd, 1899 was the day when President McKinley submitted the Treaty of Paris, by which we would take Spanish colonies, to the U.S. Senate, setting off this epic 32-day debate. On that same day, by coincidence, Carl Schurz was delivering the convocation speech at the University of Chicago. In those days, convocation speeches were a really big deal, and they always invited great figures to address the major issues of the age. So Carl Schurz delivered an 11,000-word dismemberment of the whole imperial project. He listed every argument in favor of American expansionism, the political arguments, strategic, economic, religious, all the arguments, and then he explained why all of them were wrong. I took the title of my book, The True Flag, from this speech. Now, since we're getting to the end, this time, as an exception, I'm not going to give you the whole 11,000 words. But let me just give you the passage from which I chose the title of my book. It's a wonderful conclusion for my presentation, but it's also one that shows again the unspoken theme of my book, which I think will become clear to readers, and that is how much the people in that debate have to say to us today. Here's Carl Schurz. Let us raise high the flag of our country. Not as an emblem of reckless adventure and greedy conquest, of betrayed professions and broken pledges, of criminal aggressions and arbitrary rule over subject peoples, but the old, the true flag, the flag of George Washington and Abraham Lincoln, the flag of the government of, for, and by the people, the flag of national faith held sacred and of national honor unsullied, the flag of human rights and of good example to all nations, the flag of true civilization, peace, and goodwill to all men. Thank you. Thank you so much. Did I say it all, or does anybody have a question?
Can you confirm or put to rest the old journalistic legend about, if you give me the pictures, I'll give you the war?
So I got to tell the story. William Randolph Hearst, as I said, set out to create a war in Cuba. As everybody knows who reads books, as you have, he sent an illustrator to Cuba, and the illustrator sent back a note saying, there's no war here. And he wrote back famously, you send the pictures, I'll make the war. I haven't finished yet. We all know it's true, but there's a lot of things that certain people in America know are true that really aren't true. I'm not speaking about anybody in Washington in particular. Actually, I've tried to research that quote, and I've come to conclude that the theme of it is so perfect that the fact that it may not be literally true is almost insignificant. Do you think that puts me in the mainstream in Washington now? I think that it must have happened, so therefore I think it did. Actually, there's nobody's ever seen that telegram. I don't know where that story began. But whether or not it actually happened, it should have. And that's where, in that sense, I put myself right in the line of American politics today. It doesn't matter if it's really true. It should be true.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be back here.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by author and journalist Stephen Kinzer. Mr. Kinzer's lecture was titled The True Flag: Theodore Roosevelt, Mark Twain, and the Birth of American Empire, and was presented by the Boston University Howard Gotlieb Archival Research Center. Tonight's moderator was Liz Shannon, president of the Friends of the Howard Gotlieb Archival Research Center. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, WBUR.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Ian McCarn. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Steve Brown. Thanks for joining us.